But assume that for the moment, which gives maximum late date to Abraham. He died, 8th verse, 25th chapter, having lived 175 years. After the flood, that would be 447. Shem still has another 55 years to live after Abram's dead. My guess is very few Christians ever stop to think, those who believe the Bible, that Shem lived longer than most of you yet have to live after Abram was dead. Abram wasn't the only guy around with a knowledge of God. Now, who was this Menes? Now, if you go to the Septuagint, by the way, the translation of the Old Testament into Greek with the 70 scholars down in Egypt, they extended the lives of the patriarchs. They added 100 years to each of them. Now, that means either the Jews, with the authorized versions, shortened their lives, or those in Egypt that translated the Septuagint lengthened them. So I'm telling you, you can't be too absolute on these dates, except to say it was quite a while. Menes, in most of the king lists of Egypt, takes us back to almost 3000 BC. But as I said, 2500 to 3000, 500 years ain't anything as a discrepancy that far back. Now, if there was a flood, Menes was most probably the first dynastic great king of Egypt. Who was this bird? Mizraim. M-I-Z-R-A-I-M. As it stands in the Hebrew of Genesis without the points, which is the way it did stand, is Mizraim, really. And the Mizraim signifies, quote, the encloser or embanker of the sea. No one's done more research on this than Alexander Hislop in the Two Babylons. The word Mizraim, being derived from M, the same as Yam, the sea, and Tzer, to enclose, with the formative M prefixed. If the accounts which ancient history has handed down to us of the original state of Egypt be correct, the first man who formed a settlement there must have done the very thing implied in this name. And by the way, one of the reasons why 500 years is nothing as a discrepancy that far back. Herodotus, for example, vouches for the fact that at one time there were no fewer than 12 contemporaneous kings in Egypt. Manetho, as is observed by Professor Wilkinson, has made no allusion to this, but has made his Thinite, Memphite, and Diospolitan dynasties of kings, and along etc. of others, all successive. Which means if you take Herodotus' word, some of the kings that are successively listed in Manetho's king list reigned contemporaneous, and that would chop a lot of years off. So you probably can assume anywhere from about 2000 to 3000 B.C. in that millennium when the flood occurred, if it occurred. If you believe the Bible, you believe it occurred. If you believe all the Bible records, particularly Genesis. There is no reason to assume, therefore, that Menes ruled back at a date beyond the flood. But all agree he was the first dynastic king of Egypt. Before him, history is called pre-dynastic. Who is this bird? Now, Nimrod in the Epic of Gilgamesh went looking for Noah and found him on an island in the Mediterranean west of Lebanon. In subsequent legends, place Zeus there, but he's the husband of Rhea, which means it's Nimrod. Now, did Nimrod come in and take over Noah's kingdom in Noah's old age? Did Noah found the kingdom? Is there more than an accident? As Ninus, the name of Nimrod, becomes the basis of Nineveh, is there some substance to Minoan? Now, you can go overboard with these phonetic connections, but you can also go overboard and ignore them. Mizraim, or Mithraim, means the encloser or embanker of the sea. If the accounts which ancient history has handed down to us of the original state of Egypt be correct, the first man who formed a settlement there must have done the very thing implied in this name. Diodorus Siculus tells us that in primitive times, that which, when he wrote, was Egypt, was said to have been not a country, but one universal sea. Plutarch also says that Egypt was sea. From Herodotus, too, we have very striking evidence to the same effect. He accepts the province of Thebes upriver from his statement, but when it is seen that the province of Thebes did not belong to Mizraim or Egypt property, Egypt proper, which says the author of the article Mizraim in Biblical Encyclopedia, Mizraim properly denotes Lower Egypt. The testimony of Herodotus with that meaning of Egypt as properly, or Mizraim properly denoting Lower Egypt, not counting Thebes, the testimony of Herodotus will be seen entirely to agree with that of Diodorus and Plutarch. His statement is that in the reign of the first king, the whole of Egypt except the province of Thebes was an extended marsh. No part of that which is now, no part of that which is now situated beyond the Lake Moeris was to be seen. The distance between which lake and the sea is a journey of 7 days. Thus, according to Herodotus, all Mizraim or Lower Egypt was underwater. This state of the country, which makes sense, the lowlands after the flood, arose from the unrestrained overflowing of the Nile, which, to adopt the language of Professor Wilkinson, formerly washed the foot of the sandy mountains of the Libyan chain. Now, before Egypt, certainly Lower Egypt, could be fit for being a suitable place for human abode, before it could become what it afterwards did become, one of the most fertile of all lands, it was indispensable that bounds should be set to the overflowing of the sea. And that for this purpose, great embankments should enclose or confine its waters. If Ham's son, or grandson more properly, from Cush, after his work in Babylon, if Ham's son ain't interested in this. We just joined some people, don't even know what I'm talking about. If Ham's son led a colony into Lower Egypt and settled it there, this very work he must have done. Or if Ham himself went there. And he did the work of embanking the sea. What more natural than that a name should be given him in memory of his great achievement? And what name so exactly descriptive as Mitzrim, the embanker of the sea, or as the name is found at this day applied to all Egypt? Names always tend to abbreviations in the mouth of a people. And therefore, the land of Mizr is evidently just the land of the embanker. From this statement, it follows that the embanking of the sea, the enclosing of it within certain bounds, was the making of it as a river so far as Lower Egypt was concerned. When we turn to what is recorded of the doings of Menes, now, my view is Ham went there, not his son. But whomever it was, he drove the water back. Now we turn to what's recorded of the doings of Menes, who by Herodotus, Manetho, and Diodorus alike is made the first historical king of Egypt, and compare what is said of him with this simple explanation of the meaning of the name Mizraim. How does the one, the history of Menes, cast light upon the other, the derivative of the word Mizraim, embanker or encloser of the sea? Thus does Wilkinson describe the great work which entailed fame on Menes, quote, who is allowed by universal consent, Wilkinson says, to have been the first sovereign of the country, quote, having diverted the course of the Nile, Wilkinson being quoted, which formerly washed the foot of the sandy mountains of the Libyan chain, he obliged it to run in the center of the valley, nearly at an equal distance between the two parallel ridges of mountains which border it on the east and west, and built the city of Memphis in the bed of the ancient channel. This change was effected by constructing a dike about 100 stadia above the site of the projected city, whose lofty mounds and strong embankments turned the water to the eastward and effectually confined the river to its new bed. The dike was carefully kept in repair by succeeding kings, and even as late as the Persian invasion, a guard was always maintained there to overlook the necessary repairs and watch over the state of embankments. That's from his Egyptians, Volume 1, page 89. Thus we see that Menes, the first of the acknowledged historical kings of Egypt, accomplished that very achievement which is implied in the name of Mizraim. Thus who can resist the conclusion that Menes and Mizraim are only two different names for the same person? Both names applying to the person who was either the son or the grandson of Noah himself. And notice the word he uses here, Ham, or Ham's son, leading a colony into Lower Egypt. Now back to the Baptist. John D. Pilkey, Associate Professor of English at Los Angeles Baptist College in Newhall, California. PhD from the University of Kansas in 74. Master's in Theology from Dallas Theological Seminary. I don't let him get away with anything, even with fundamentalists. Dispensational theologians, he says, Those are those that have figured out God has one set of rules for one dispensation, and boom, down comes an invisible wall, and another set of rules apply. It's a crock. But, to read on, dispensational theologians have accurately recognized that Noah inaugurated a new dispensation of human government after the flood. The Sumerian king list attests to the same fact, claiming that kingship descended from heaven after the flood. This descent of power was far more like the Christian Pentecost than we imagine. Its universal Gentile symbol was the cosign, the pictograph image of a man with arms upraised at the elbows. The ka was the spiritual entity by which the pharaohs participated in deity and acquired their theocratic powers. The ka sign recurs among other nations. The Japanese bonsai salute is a classic instance. Among members of a Ural-Altaic linguistic stock which ranks high among the languages of Noah's theocracy. The most striking example of the ka posture is found as a sign of deity in the imagery of the Gundestrup cauldron, a Celtic artifact discovered in Denmark, listen to the date, in the spring of 1891. In the exterior panels of the cauldron, the ka posture is duplicated in each depiction of the four male members of a set of four males and what are believed to have been four females. It is impossible to imagine a more graphic portrayal of the idea of a cosmos arriving from eight survivors of a universal flood. Four male, four female, as biblical tradition affirms. Arranged in a circle, the exterior panels and their internal counterparts are embodiments of a cosmos, as anthropologists have easily recognized. Unfortunately, most anthropologists are not known for their devotion to the Bible, and as a class are not well equipped to perceive an analogy which is as obvious as anyone could wish. The Celts portrayed on the Gundestrup cauldron were the ancient people of Bronze Age Europe. Now, the Bronze Age, the term Bronze Age, is empirical jargon for the early post-diluvian world of Noah. And the dates will match. If kingship descended from heaven, and I remember the first time I smoked a cigar on TV, that happened. Made my mother happy. If kingship descended from heaven in a revolutionary way, just like that ash fell, after the flood, it and its civilizing effects were largely unknown before the flood. The Egyptian mythology of Osiris identifies this god as a civilizing agent, and the same could be said of all gods, including Moses. Gods in quotes by this Baptist. These were a race of charismatic geniuses without whom high civilization would never have been realized. The god of Noah, he says, created world civilization through a Pentecost of power, just as surely as the church is the concrete, historically defined product of apostolic power. Any recognition of Noah's family, however, in the Gundestrup octad, or cauldron, must face critical skepticism and the larger issue of historical verification. The cauldron speaks through mythological imagery and contains no script. Let me skip a little. His thesis is that on this cauldron, various faces with the cosine and supporting images, take a picture of one. Each one of the faces has a lot of supporting image to go with it. That's the panel of the boar holding men. Another one of them. This eight-sided cauldron. There's another one. Holding a deer, not a boar. And each of the four faces portray four men, and he said what appear to be four women. There's a panel of the two dragons. Can't cross-eyed any. There's a panel of the boxer and the dancer. And the boar-holding man. Now, Genesis 10 and Genesis 11 are just as difficult to interpret. Stay with me a minute. During 20 years of study, he says, the central interpretive task in dealing with Genesis 10 has been to determine the concrete genetic history of Noah's family. The names in Genesis 11 form a genealogy. Those in Genesis 10 do not. Even in Genesis 11, mothers are never named. Maternity forms a missing dimension of genetic linkage. And I read this earlier. We have found that the female survivors of the flood were quite powerful, and that a certain fraction of the names in Genesis 10 refer to females on the personal level, and he lists several. The maternal factor was supremely important because Noah's task of preserving a plenitude of racial types... Hey, this is a Baptist I'm reading. From the antediluvian world was necessary. In Genesis 10, the names Cush and Havilah reproduce the names of two antediluvian regions grouped together in the system of the four rivers in Genesis 2. Curiously, the name Havilah appears twice in Genesis 10, once in the Cushite section, again in the Joktanite section. The reason for this is that the two persons named in these sections were genetic bearers of the racial type which had inhabited the antediluvian land of Havilah in Genesis 2:11. Now, in their lack of human ancestry, Adam and Eve were apocalyptic. Standing at the boundary between the natural and supernatural. A basic rule of apocalypse, and they were apocalyptic, is the ritual symmetry of metaphysics, the visible disclosure of such things as the four elements and four humors. Such symmetries are the stock in trade of pagan tradition because of the diligence of Noah's family in preserving the Adamic heritage under the new empowerment of the dispensation of human government. If this were important, I'd translate it. The racial types, I'm getting up to something, which evolutionists treat as the casual accumulation of individual variations, express a fourfold metaphysical potentiality within the gene pool of the first couple. One thing that's good about teaching like this, it quickly eliminates those who would listen to Jimmy Swaggart or Jerry Falwell. Such a system appears in the Mesoamerican tradition of the four Tezcatlipocus. How do you pronounce that ancient Aztec name? Tezcatlipocus. Red, but I understand the rest of it here. And I understand the name. I don't know how to pronounce it. I've encountered the name before. And it is a Mesoamerican tradition of the four progenitors of their race. Red Chack, Black Ed, White Zack, and Yellow Khan. These colors, red, black, white, and yellow, assigned to the four ordinal directions, match the four basic racial types of mankind in their concepts. The red Amerinds of the two Americas, the blacks of the Indian Ocean, whites of Europe, and yellow Mongoloids of the four East. These races are a living document of Adamic genetic potential and Noahic eugenic control. A fundamental goal of Genesis 10 study is to discover which survivors embodied which races and how these strains were mixed and consolidated in the earliest post-diluvian offspring. The four males of the Ark could not be the key to race because three were the sons of the fourth, necessarily sharing his racial character. Instead, races were embodied in the four wives, who were selected for this purpose from the four racial stocks implied by the fourfold antediluvian cosmos out of Genesis 2, verses 10 to 14. Still with me?
Yes, sir.
There you read, "Now a river went out of Eden," Eden meaning the heart of God, "to water the garden, and from it parted and became four riverheads." Now, I'm not bothered at all with evolution. Because Genesis doesn't say God created man. It says he created Adam and breathed into him, Ruach being the word, his breath. And it doesn't say man became a living soul. It says Adam became a living soul. A living problem with evolution. I know it's a hypothesis, and there are gaps that you must assume by faith. It takes about as much faith to believe in evolution as does anything. But I don't have any trouble believing things evolve, including man-like creatures, including whatever they want to come up with as missing links. I can find some for them. Some of them are evangelists. But Adam was a new creation. And out of the heart of God, there's a fourfold flow, four riverheads. The name of the first is Pishon. It's the one that encompasses the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold. And the gold of that land is good. Bdellium and the onyx stone are there. The name of the second river is Gihon. It is the one which encompasses the whole land of Cush. The name of the third is Hiddekel. It's the one that goes toward the east of Assyria. The fourth river is Euphrates. Henry M. Morse has noted the anachronistic effect of this passage, which blends together two worlds, the antediluvian and post-diluvian, is channeled through the minds of the original authors, in all probability Adam and Noah themselves, assigned to two of the four riverheads or the names of the lands, Havilah and Cush. Both names reappear in Genesis 10, establishing traditional continuity between the two worlds. Although the passage in Genesis 2, this Baptist says, contains no reference to race, we are justified in giving its geographical system racial value because of the familiar value of the name Cush. Traditionally, this name represents a land on the upper river Nile in black East Africa, south of Egypt. The lands of Cush and Egypt were regionally complementary in the same way that the names Cush and Mizraim head the list of Ham's sons in Genesis 10:6. If these two sons are embodied in the peoples of Ethiopia, Cush, and Egypt, they were racially distinct because the ancient Egyptians were fair-skinned in contrast with their Ethiopian neighbors. The implication is that Cush was Ham's son by a distinctly black woman, one of the four female survivors of the flood. The duplication of the antediluvian name, Cush, from Genesis 2, in this woman's son implies that she was a representative of the antediluvian land of Cush and its race, the black quarter of Adam's progeny. The corollary race of Havilah was the Amerind stock, traditionally conceived as red, but distinguished by another racial characteristic, facial concavity, the familiar hook nose, physiognomy. In Amerind folklore, the colors red and black are often grouped together. The Aztec god. Here we go again. Is reckoned red and black. And the same colors combine in masks of northwestern North America, where a ritual involving red and black arrows is also found. A Mesoamerican painting shows a warlike race painted blood red, conquering black enemies. This coupling of reds and blacks echoes the antediluvian formula of Havilah and Cush. The two Havilahs of Genesis 10 are the red matriarch appearing in the Joktanite section and her antediluvian son Ham, who adopts the name Havilah as vassal to his own black son Cush in 10:7, Genesis 10:7. The same two are pictured in the system of the exterior Gundestrup panels as chief subjects of the braided goddess and dragon panels, where both display the same tendency toward facial concavity. The exterior panel of the black matriarch is missing, but she appears twice in the panel of the braided goddess as an attendant, symbolic of the distinct black races of Dravidian India and Cushite East Africa. A limitation of the text of Genesis 2 is that the author does not bother to assign regional names to the antediluvian versions, the ones before the flood of the Tigris, Hiddekel, and Euphrates, unless we take the anachronistic reference to Assyria as such. However, another antediluvian regional name, Nod, appears in the account of the curse of Cain in Genesis 4:6. The simplest explanation for the omitted regional names in Genesis 2 is that the author himself was familiar with the antediluvian lands of Tigris and Euphrates because these were his own homeland. That's where he was writing from. He names Havilah and Cush explicitly as remote from his experience. The racial implication is that the author was neither Amerind nor black, but belonged either to the Mongoloid or Caucasoid stock. Another evidence of the same limitation is his preoccupation with just two antediluvian stocks, Sethites and Cainites. These two stocks identify with the Mongoloids and the Caucasoids, respectively. The racist view that the blacks are Cainite, and there were some Baptists that used to preach that black was the mark of Cain. That racist view is entirely untenable, because of the clear distinction between the lands of Cush and Nod. The sign of Cain was the low pigmentation extreme of fair skin, and the antediluvian Cainite civilization was a prototype of the high material civilization achieved by the whites of Europe. Noah, as a Sethite, was chiefly Mongoloid, and his features in the Gundestrup panel of the boar-holding men are distinctly brachycephalic, broad-skulled, a standard Mongoloid trait. And he married a descendant of Cain. That was his wife. That's where the white is further supported. Isn't that interesting? I think that's very interesting. Cain was distinguishable by being white. And his descendant, the wife of Noah, was a Cainite. I mean, was the white matriarch. Any reader of the... Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Any reader of the Old Testament realizes that marital irregularities existed on a large scale in ancient times. That means one of the current television evangelists is carrying on the tradition. It would be rather strange if Noah, father of the Gentiles, had practiced a higher standard of marital ethics than polygamous Abraham, ancestor of the Israelites, or polygamous David and Solomon, leading kings of Israel. More important, a certain degree of marital irregularity by our standards is built into the biblical scheme of origins. Adam and Eve could generate a world community only through sibling incest among their children. People say, where'd Cain get his wife? From his sister. Incest. To all appearances, Noah and his three sons were monogamous. Why else were the survivors of the flood confined to 8 persons? It is quite clear that each of the 4 females who survived the flood was reckoned the political wife of one and only one of the 4 surviving males. The principle of monogamy was well established in some peculiar code of behavior. Yet we can be equally certain that that code also included various degrees of sibling incest, and along with it a pattern of polygamous concubinage rooted in eugenic planning. Takes a Baptist to put that rationale on it. If each of the 4 Noahic couples had practiced strict monogamy, each would have duplicated the function of Adam and Eve in establishing his own separate version of the human race. 4 racial stocks of mankind would have to be traced back to the 4 surviving males, as though Noah and his 3 sons were all racially diverse. Furthermore, we would expect to find a central type of each color group. A single true black race, red race, yellow race, and white race. Such is not the case. The Dravidian blacks of India represent a distinct type from the blacks of Africa, just as true, but radically different. The whites of Europe have been distinguished into Nordic, Alpine, and Mediterranean types. And the Amerindians display a characteristic red type in South and Central America, and a more mongoloid type in the north. To the biblical monogenist, these distinctions are far from haphazard. I'm surprised the Baptist got away with even thinking about this, much less writing about it. The simplest and best explanation is that these radical diversities within each color group derived from a process of eugenic polygamy within Noah's immediate family. Because all 4 males were closely related, I'm going to hit Sacramento right in the middle of this. I'm reading from Origin of the Nations by John Pilkey, a Baptist, teacher at a Baptist college here in Los Angeles. And he's saying concerning Noah, the simplest and best explanation is that these radical diversities within each color group of the races of man derive from a process of eugenic polygamy within Noah's immediate family. What a thing to introduce a new half hour with. Because all 4 males were closely related, they could not have displayed enough variation genetically to account for the distinctly colored groups by the close of the 3rd millennium. But this limitation did not apply to the females, whose parentage is not specified, except for Noah's wife, and who could easily have been chosen to represent a plenitude of all the antediluvian racial types. They are the key to the early appearance of the 4 basic color groups, and their polygamous relationship to the sons of Noah accounts for the radical distinctions within each group, assuming that each male was enough like Adam in genetic potential to place his peculiar stamp on each group. For example, we have found that African blacks descended from Ham's black son, Cush. Dravidian blacks from Noah's black son, Riphath, a vassal to Gomer. How did Noah, mongoloid, married to the white matriarch, produce a black son? Oceanic blacks came from Japheth's black son, Seba, a vassal to Cush. And the Amorite, how do you get a black son? And the Amerindian blacks, the Olmecs, from Shem's black son, Hul, a vassal to Aram, which you find in Genesis 11. They're all producing black sons. The black mommy got around. All four men were half-brothers by the same mother, the universal black matriarch, a sole survivor of the antediluvian race of the land of Cush. Now, the red, yellow, and white mamas were not going to be outdone either. You ain't interested in this. I'll bet this is what you're about the only thing you're really interested in for a long time. The high longevities of Noah's immediate family combined with the Gentile Pentecost of human government to make that family the most astounding aristocracy the world has known. Nothing in human experience can compare with it short of the Christian apocalypse. According to Genesis 11:11, Shem lived for 502 years after the flood, roughly the second half of the third millennium. During this period, all but one of the 25 dynasties of the Sumerian king list and the first 12 dynasties of Egypt ran their course. Shem outlived most of them and shared in a number of them, appearing as Bali in the international dynasty of First Kish, as Dadazig of Second Kish, as Tada of Awan, as Salamu of the Amorites, and as Melchizedek of the late Abrahamic period of Genesis 14. Glad for one Baptist that recognizes that he was Melchizedek who founded Jerusalem. Now we can trace in the ancient legends in history the activities of Balai of the international dynasty of Kish, First Kish, Dadazig of Second Kish, he's Tada of Awan, Salamu of the Amorites, Melchizedek of the late Abram period. He personally authored, he got around, the entire Indo-European linguistic stock, inherited the Semitic stock as his personal possession, governed both stocks in his fief of Akkad, and reigned afterward as a Sumerian, an Ural-Altaic, an Amorite, and an Egyptian. Joseph was not the first Semite to know Egypt. Shem camped 42 years on the Nile, 2 centuries before the nation of Mizraim existed. In the Maristic pantheons of the nations, he was the Sumerian Ishkar, Syrian Adad, Ugaritic Alianbal, Egyptian Amon of Thebes, Hellenic Heracles, Celtic Tutadi, Teutonic Thor. Now that lays a framework to study for the next 6 months. Yeah. If you're interested. And he just might have built the pyramid. from plans provided by Enoch if Enoch himself didn't build it earlier. Which leads me to Colonel Weiss. One more chapter. And that's God's grace and scholars. Where the hell did Weiss go? He's so tricky, you never know where Weiss is. Here. Why should I just keep teaching and you not call me? You got a mouthful tonight. Shall I get back into this stuff?
Yes, sir.
Huh?
Yes, sir.
You got to tie them all together, you know. Shem got around. Four active women and four hungry men. What a Bible story. Reading from The Origin of Nations by John Pilkey, a Baptist, graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary, teacher in a Baptist college here in Los Angeles. In the present study, Shem has served to synthesize a variety of remote ethnic traditions. Two of the most fascinating are supplied by physical artifacts from Gundestrup, the Gundestrup cauldron, with the eight images on it, four men and four women, and from Lagash in the eastern part of ancient Sumer, the Noahic land of lower Mesopotamia. The similarity between these two imageries is self-evident. The images of Shem on the Gundestrup cauldron had associated Shem with a very peculiar set of images before a totally distinct process turned up the same combination of images at Lagash as the depiction of a totally distinct version of the same patriarch. Archaeology, in short, dug up at Lagash a similar portrayal of the person identified as Shem on the cauldron. In effect, a reading of the Gundestrup cauldron predicted the existence of an artifact at Lagash. Of the four males of the Gundestrup exterior panels, the subject of the Hirschnitter panel, you've seen it before, with the stags on each side. That male image on the panel was found to represent Shem. Rudolf Grossi's ethical interpretation of the panel matched the implications of Shem's identifications with the Syrian Hadad, Teutonic Thor, and Greek Heracles. Each of these identifications claimed its own argument. But unifying them all was a perception that the Yahweh Elohim of Shem, named in Genesis 9:26, was known to the Noahic polytheists as a god of storm. Hence, Shem's identity with the heroic storm gods Hadad and Thor, together with the traditional identification of Thor with the hero Heracles, as these personages were deified in later legends. The Gundestrup tradition added that the Celtic brethren of the Teutons remembered a version of Shem between two stags in either hand. A separate line of argument traced Shem's political and mythological image through the Sumero-Akkadian tradition of Mesopotamia. As Hyslop and all Christian separatists recognized, the Mesopotamian world order became alienated from the god of Shem, thanks to Cush and Nimrod, and presumably alienated from Shem himself. We have found that the source of this alienation lay in the curse-blessing event of Genesis 9:26, a theocratic revolution favoring Shem and based on Noah's alienation from Ham. The revolution split the Noahic world into two warring factions, and the opposition faction, headed by Canaan, Sidon, and Nimrod, gained the upper hand in shaping the traditions of Mesopotamia. In the Sumerian tradition, their legends, flowing out of a worship of Nimrod, the tradition, therefore, is hostile to Shem, and the revolution in their legends is termed a theft of Enlilship, that is, of the power to control the Semitic linguistic stock, and ultimately to establish law codes in the manner of Ur-Nammu, Hammurabi, and Moses. Shem obtained these privileges legitimately through Noah's blessing of the Yahweh Elohim of Shem and succeeded historically in imposing his name on the Semites and in precedenting the law of Moses. But in Sumerian mythology, he became the thief of the Enlilship, the monstrous bird Zu, antagonist to Ninurta, another name for Nimrod. At Lagash, an early capital of Canaan's faction, the Zu appears as the Imdugud, or rain cloud bird, subject of one of the most beautiful pagan artifacts ever discovered. Like the Gundestrup cauldron of the Celts, in their version of Shem, the Zu, or Imdugud, the enemy or antagonist of Ninurta, which is Nimrod in that legend, the Zu or Imdugud, which is none other than Shem, is pictured between two stags at both the Lagash pictorial representation and the Gundestrup cauldron. The point is that the two entirely separate synthetic or pictorial representations of Shem at work in two remote cultures ended in two very different portrayals of the peculiar symbolic idea that Shem stood between two stags. Further interpretation. Now we're going to get to the stags. But you don't care. More music!